father's prized possession was a 1971 R60/5 BMW motorcycle. And when he died, my brother, the eldest, took ownership of the Beamer. My brother rode it for several years, then decided to refurbish the bike. He didn't get much farther than stripping it down to 1,000 pieces before the project stalled about 6 years ago. Last year, when I sold my bike, I offered to take on the reassembly project. My brother agreed and handed over an engine, a frame, a gas tank, two wheels, and boxes and bags of filthy parts, largely unlabeled and, as it turned out, somewhat incomplete. For the past 7 months, I have worked through figuring out what goes where, what's broken, what's missing, and how to transform random bags of parts into a functioning motorcycle. I have faced each challenge with as much patience as I could muster and asked for help and support from friends, relatives, books, and the internet community. Each part cleaned, repaired, and replaced was a labor of love, joy, and an opportunity to focus on the task in front of me while keeping the overall vision in mind and staying curious about how would it all work, and in fact, would it all work in the end. I worked on myself more than I worked on the bike, staying curious when I was frustrated with self-imposed deadlines. As much as figuring out the mechanics and bolting parts together, I was figuring out when to try harder, when to step back, and when to ask for help. And every step was a lesson in accepting what is. On July 2nd, as documented on Facebook, that bike came back to life, idling smoothly. And as planned, July 6th, I started an inaugural motorcycle tour of Washington and BC. The first evening of the trip, on a remote stretch of Washington State Highway 20, I was cruising happily around a left-hand bend at 100 kilometers per hour. Suddenly, a strong wind gusted across the road, and I lost control of the carefully cleaned and assembled, but largely untested, motorcycle. The bike went down, and I slid and rolled across the hot, hard pavement. My newly painted and pinstriped front fender was destroyed. My handlebars were bent. My headlight was smashed. And many other parts, including my personal body, were also bent, bruised, and scraped. As you can imagine, this could have been devastating emotionally, physically, and mechanically. But I managed to realize that the project, me and the bike, is not yet done. I managed to stay with the theme of the project being more about working on myself. I stayed curious and stayed focused on living in the moment, feeling gratitude for what was good as opposed to what could have been. And I went into problem-solving mode again. Through the kindness of strangers and my recent intimate knowledge of how that bike goes together, I and the bike were patched up and on the road again the next afternoon, and we completed a 2,000-kilometer road trip without further mishap. What an adventure life is.
It's such a pleasure to be here this morning and to see some familiar faces and to have my daughter here with us and to meet some new folks as well. As Jerry said, I study at Vancouver School of Theology, and I have taken a couple of courses now on the mystics. And the more I read and study about mysticism, the more ill-equipped I feel to make any comment on the subject. However, I am completely enamored with mysticism in its many forms and guises, so I press on. The concepts are vast, the library expanse, and the information would take lifetimes to understand. This morning, I'd like to talk about a few mystics, share some details, and think about what makes them mystics. I think of the mystical experience in relationship to our first source, direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces that create and uphold life. I want us to think about our own inner mystic. What is a mystic? Is it someone who sees visions or maybe is persecuted for their beliefs? Do you have to be imprisoned unjustly and burned at the stake like Marguerite of Porrette to be a mystic, or be walled in and be an anchoress like Julian of Norwich was? Maybe a mystic doesn't wear shoes like Teresa of Avila, a descaled Carmelite nun. Maybe to be a mystic, a person has to give up all their possessions and live in poverty like poor Claire, or her mentor, Francis of Assisi. What about the Sufi mystic, Rumi, whose words we sang during our opening hymn? What made him a mystic? Maybe it's someone who taps into their own inner divine. I think about mystics as people that take the divine energy and move it, share it in the world. Last summer, I took a course on Thomas Merton, and I just finished another one this summer, last weekend. I remember thinking how much I would love the course because it was about mystics. But I didn't know what a mystic was, and I'm not sure I do now either. However, my understanding is that a mystic has taken their direct experience with the divine and used it to ground them in their own faith. At the same time, they move out, working to improve the world in which they find themselves. I think we all have the potential to be a mystic. I wonder if a mystical experience is one where we experience awe or are moved by a touching story. I have noticed that no matter what tradition a mystic is from, be it Kabbalah or Sufism, the mystic traditions of Judaism and Islam, or Christian or Buddhism, there are some defining similarities I see in all of them. The first is that all mystics claim to have had a direct experience with the divine. The second is the acknowledgement the path to God or the divine is the path into ourselves. And the third, most mystics believe the divine energy they experience calls them to move out into the world to reduce suffering. So as I've said, my theory is we are all mystics. I believe we all have the potential to have a direct experience of the divine. We are all walking through this dimension we call life and trying to do the best we can. I believe we all take the time and energy to make the world a better place. Have you ever written something and come back to read it later and wonder, where did that come from? Or said exactly the right thing to a person who needed your words? How about the time you were in the forest and you were transcended by the beauty and majesty? Last summer, some of us met at a spiritual retreat put on by the Vancouver Island Unitarian Council, and I overheard someone tell a story. This person had been a worship leader like Jerry is this morning, and after the service, someone came up to them and told them that their words had helped. It was exactly what they needed to hear at the time. I like to think about these experiences as times when we have gotten around and over ourselves long enough to let go of the self or of the ego. We've gotten ourselves out of the way. We've stopped thinking. In her book, The Silent Cry, Dorothea Zola says, "Mystics are quite ordinary people. Shoemakers, nannies, dyers of wool, home care workers, or physicists. The God or the divine experienced in mysticism is not one of the beati possidentes, which means those who belong to the blessed adept. No, mystics aren't special. They're just us. At VST, Vancouver School of Theology, I took a course called Clothed in God, Women Mystics and the Christian Tradition. In this class, we learned about some of the women mystics through the ages. We read examples of their work, the primary text, learned about their lives, and placed them into historical context. We also reflected upon them through the lens of our own theology, mine being very liberal. One of the first women we studied was Hildegard von Bingen, a woman born in 1098. She came from a very wealthy family and was brought to a Dominican monastery and left there when she was about 10 years old. She was the 10th child of the family, and so she was given to the church as a tithe. She was an offering. She was very sickly and was cursed with blinding headaches. She saw visions and interpreted them, dictating them to scribes. Her interpretations, very Trinitarian. However, interestingly enough for a woman who was celibate, her visions, depictions of her visions, are quite erotic. She not only wrote about her visions, she also wrote music, books about the physical world and the healing properties of plants, animals, and minerals. As well, she wrote about the physical body. She was encouraged to write and was eventually named a doctor of the church. So why did Hildegard stand up? She's probably the one mystic that everybody may have heard about. I think because she was educated at a time when women were not allowed to be educated, and she was writing and publishing at a time when women weren't actually supposed to be doing that. She traveled extensively, and she built the first abbey for women. Before that, women were cloistered in with the men. She fought hard and won papal approval to build her own abbey. It was the first convent ever built, and it was in Bingen, Germany. You might say to yourself, Hildegard was a Catholic nun who believed in the divinity of Christ and in the Trinity. What can she possibly offer us? 21st century enlightened Unitarians. I think plenty. One of my instructors, Janet Gere, has a favorite line, and she says, go deep in order to go wide, and then go deep again, and then go wider still. This is what Hildegard did. She had visions. She used them to gain meaningful insight to the divine, meaningful to her. She lived many of our Unitarian principles. When the women and girls in her care were unhappy living with the men, some of them felt unsafe, she listened and fought to bring them into safety, taking their worth and dignity into account. She learned about the world around her and discovered how the earth sustains us and heals us, an expert in the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. She had a direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder and told the world about it. She knew she could be accused of being a heretic, which she was, but she did it anyway. She came up against the edges of patriarchy, religious intolerance, and papal authority, and she pushed. She went deep within her, and then she went wide. She was never content, and she continually spoke up and out. She saw a need, and she stepped up. Another woman, Dorothy Day, saw need and stepped up. Here are some of the things she has to say. Don't call me a saint. I don't want to be dismissed so easily. People say, what is the sense of our small effort? They cannot see. We must lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. A pebble cast into the pond causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, words, and deeds is like that. No one has the right to sit down and feel helpless. There is too much work to do. I have long since come to believe that people never mean half of what they say, and that it is best to disregard their talk and judge only their actions. Dorothy Day was a very interesting woman. She left a well-off and bohemian lifestyle to live a life of service. She was co-founder of the Catholic Worker magazine and movement in 1933. She lived and worked in New York City, serving soup and kindness to the poor. She practiced voluntary poverty, giving up personal possessions and personal private space, which I think would have been even more difficult, to emulate the homeless she served. Saint Thérèse of Lisieux and what she called the Little Way inspired Dorothy Day. This little way is a commitment to the tasks and to the people we meet in our everyday lives. She calls us to do something. Don't call me a saint. I don't want to be dismissed so easily. In other words, don't let yourself off the hook, she says, just because you can't devote your entire life to ending the pain and suffering of the world. She says, I'm no saint. I'm just like you, a mere human. We can all do something. So I ask you, who is in front of you that you are kind to, that you help, that you build up with your smile and encouragement? Perhaps you make the coffee that is so welcome in the morning. Or you greet us with a cheery smile, or edit the newsletter. This is the little way, the way of the mystic. Here's another way to think of the mystic, from Richard Rohr. Richard of St. Victor wrote that humanity was given three different sets of eyes, each building on the previous one. The first eye was the eye of the flesh, the senses. The second was the eye of reason, that's meditation or intellectual reflection. And the third eye was the eye of true understanding, contemplation. The third eye seeing is the way mystics see. They do not reject the first eye, the senses matter to them, nor do they reject the second eye, but they know not to confuse knowledge with depth or mere correct information with the transformation of consciousness itself. They are led still further. Jamal Rahman wrote a book called The Spiritual Gifts of Islam. He says, once we awaken to the reality of our higher self, our first tentative steps along the path will grow ever stronger and more certain as we engage in the lifelong process of freeing the ego from its self-attachment and surrendering to the divinity at the core of our being. And how shall we accomplish this lofty goal? The sages say we must polish our hearts and minds as if they were rubies in the rough. For our divine ruby light to shine from within, we must continue and never cease the work of refining all facets of our intellect and heart. If we stop polishing because we get irritated by every rub, how will we ever smooth out the rough edges? End of quote. I would add, we must continually seek opportunities to be polished. Complacency, comfort, and contentment will not achieve this. Sometimes being uncomfortable, challenged, and confronted with ideas not our own will create the opportunity for refining the facets of our intellect and heart. The work is never finished. I just wrote a paper on the Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism. The Kabbalah is said to be mystical, esoteric, and dangerous. Mystical because there are claims of the direct experience of the divine. Esoteric because it has been guarded and kept for a select few, passed down from teacher to student. And dangerous because the way of the Kabbalah is treacherous. The reason it is treacherous is because it is said that it is a path unto and into ourselves. The Sufi mystic Al-Ghazali, born 100 years before Rumi, states, knowledge of self is the key to the knowledge of the divine. Kabbalists believed this is a dangerous path one not to be taken lightly, and only with a teacher to help guide the way. The Zohar is the Kabbalist text, and it is said some of it was composed through automatic writing, a technique in which the mystic would meditate on a divine name, enter a trance, and begin to write whatever came to his hand. The last mystic I would like to tell you about is most assuredly my favorite one. Her name was Marguerite of Porrette, a French mystic who died in 1310. I have been deeply moved by her writings and by the piety in which she lived her life. In her writings, I believe she is saying, you need to leave your fancy theological education at the door and humble yourself. You can't learn what I'm about to tell you. You have to live it, be it, and most of all, feel it. Understanding what is important does not come through books, but through your heart and soul. She had a direct and transcendent experience of the divine. She speaks of the life force, the energy that fuels our spiritual lives. She encourages us to go beyond reason and let that energy reside in our bodies. Marguerite spoke about how we are such complex and terrific beings. She has it right when she says we have so many facets. She also says we just are, and we needn't do anything else to be perfect. Jesus, of course, speaks of the soul, a difficult concept sometimes for us Unitarians, and her thinking was pretty radical for the 1300s. She didn't have any other language to say what she meant, as everything was about religion in those days. Is it a physiological response she's talking about? Is there such a thing as the soul? I don't know, and I don't think it really matters. I'm going to use her language, though, because I think it is very beautiful. She says, the soul not need do anything because the soul is perfect love. Even though the soul doesn't need to do anything, the soul never leaves out anything that could be done. It can't be taught or given anything or anything taken away. It is complete, and in this completeness there is understanding. This understanding is inherent in the soul, has nothing to do with teachings, but comes from the life forces within. Stating these things, she got the attention of the Vatican, as you can well imagine, because she's basically telling them that we don't need the Vatican. She wrote a book called The Mirror of Simple Souls, and it was banned and burned. She, as well, was burned at the stake in 1310. It is said the onlookers were moved to tears by her pious demeanor. Her writings have influenced many other mystics, including Meister Eckhart. What I have taken away from her writing is that we are perfect just the way we are. We don't have to do anything but be ourselves to be worthy of love. This generous message of grace is one I can live with. I would like to conclude with these words by Reverend John Russell. I've adapted them a little bit to make them more Unitarian. Catholics and others have been attracted to St. Thérèse's style. Her little way seems to put holiness of life within the reach of ordinary people. Live out your days with confidence that you are loved. Recognize that each day is a gift in which your life can be a difference in the way you choose to live it. Put hope in a future in which the divine will be all and love will consume your spirit. Choose life, not the darkness of pettiness and greed. St. Thérèse knew the difference love makes by allowing love to be the statement she made each day of her life. That is my hope for each and every one of us. So may it be. Amen.
Thank you, Rosemary. Please rise as you're willing and able to join us in our closing song, number 1008 in your hymnal. Oh, we don't have it? Okay. Okay, so we're going to switch to number 131. Is that okay, Victoria?
Let me check the number.
Okay. So, I think it's appropriate. We just talked about perfection being just exactly as we are. So, is that okay, Victoria? Can you do number 131? Is that okay, Victoria? Okay. All right. Okay, so number 131, Love Will Guide Us. Journey. Having a destination seems to be the reason for the journey, but I am starting to think that it is the smallest part. Okay, I invite you to join hands, hearts, and voices in singing our closing song, Carry the Flame. The words are in your order of service.